You've got all this technology here. you should see the wires that are behind this podium. Well, good morning and welcome to everyone. So glad that you were able to make it here today. I know the conditions outside are not exactly the most favorable, but we have a terrific topic this morning and a terrific guest who's going to give a presentation that I know that you're going to enjoy. I'm Steve Johnson. I'm the outgoing director of the Americas program here. And before we get started, I just want to take a moment to thank CSIS for the great 2 years that I've had in residence here, 2 years in which I've rubbed shoulders with some giants, including some of our program's affiliates and our program coordinator, Michael Graybill, who's standing in the corner and in the back. He's actually the person that makes this whole thing run. I would also like to introduce the gentleman who is going to take my place and who happens to be a close friend and colleague going back many years. Many of you already know him. His name is Carl Meacham. Carl, are you here? He's a former senior professional staff member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee who worked for Senator Richard Lugar. He has extensive experience in the U.S. foreign policy arena and hemispheric relations, and is highly regarded within the region. And I know he's going to bring tons of new ideas to the program. So if you would, please join me in welcoming Carl Meacham to the program. Now on to this morning's topic. From the 1980s forward, immigration and particularly illegal immigration have become sort of the third rail in American politics, as increasing numbers of migrants, mostly from Mexico, have come to the United States in search of employment. And studies have shown that certain economic conditions, demographic pressures, and lack of opportunity have helped push them out of Mexico, as much as economic growth and the availability of jobs and also a porous border have pulled them into the U.S. economy. Stronger laws, quotas on certain types of immigrants, and the lack of a flexible system of managing temporary workers have led to many of them staying, such that the population of Mexican-born persons now in the United States equals about 10% of Mexico's own population. Roughly half are undocumented. Now, as a new round of debate centers on reforms in our Congress, the net inflow has come to a halt. And in fact, as many as 600,000 have gone home in the last 2 years, even though the U.S. economy is recovering from the 2009 recession. Now, in the background, our neighbor to the south is undergoing a transformation in an effort to catch up economically, politically, and socially. It's no secret that after NAFTA, Mexico agreed to nearly a dozen more free trade agreements with about 40 different countries. Its economy has stabilized. Instead of having periodic peso crises like in the past, it has minor dips and peaks and is now growing at an average of about 3%. Reforms have picked up over the last decade, like Mexico's rapid business startup system, and within the past 6 months have taken off with an overhaul of the labor code and changes curbing the power of the teachers' union. To help us make sense of the changes in Mexico and the changing migration pattern, we've invited Gustavo Mojar, who led migration discussions in the United States for the Fox administration and who served President Felipe Calderon as the subsecretary for population migration and religious affairs in Mexico's Secretariado de Gobernación. And to put Gustavo's comments in the context of what reforms are possible on this side of the border, we've also asked Lindsay Lowell, director of Georgetown University's Policy Studies Institute for the Study of International Migration, to comment. Now, Mr. Lowell has not joined us just yet. We understand that he's stuck in traffic on his way in from Virginia, and we hope that the traffic jam eases soon so that he can join us. So he will get here when he gets here. But after our guests have spoken, we'll have time for your questions and answers. And for now, please join me in welcoming Gustavo Mojar. Thank you.
Very good morning. Buenos dias. Let me start by thanking CSIS and the Americas program, Steve, for your very kind invitation, and for Michael, who's around here, that helped me to be here today. When I was invited to talk about the new landscape of Mexico-U.S. migration, because of my story of almost 17 years working on Mexico-U.S. relations, and starting precisely as a representative of the Ministry of Gobernación in the U.S., in the Mexican Embassy in Washington, I came here just before the last immigration reform of 1996. So I had a chance to begin to realize how complicated it is to discuss immigration policies and politics in Washington. And I had since then an opportunity to follow up what has been the dialogue and be participant as a Mexican official with the U.S. Government and with the U.S. NGOs and with the U.S. church and with the U.S. media about how much do we really understand each other's views. And then in Mexico also I talk, of course, with my colleagues at the government, at academia, at the media, at the NGOs, with the migrants themselves. And I am wondering why and how is it possible that being neighbors for so long, we know so little about each other. And how much misperceptions guide our relations. And that's why I try to say these things, calling my presentation or my comments like a brief overview and some myths, truths, and lies. It's not sex, videotapes, and lies, but myths, truths, and lies, and changing paradigms. And I think that's the phrase that I would like to elaborate a little more as long as I talk to you about what is at stake on this immigration reform debate in the U.S. and how did we get here, you get here, not us, you get here, the U.S. So thank you very much once again for the invitation. These bullets, I will elaborate quickly because I would like to have more time to interchange questions and try to give answers. As you see, I think that to understand, and these bullets try to give just a snapshot of the long-term history between Mexico and the U.S. on migration particularly. Of course, I should have left out, certainly I left out a lot of things, but this is basically what I thought can give you a perspective of time. What are we talking about here? First of all, the vicinity, geographically speaking and historically speaking, all over the world determines a lot of how countries relate to each other. Therefore, the U.S. has only one neighbor in the South. And it seems to me we will continue to be neighbors for a long time. So that in itself creates a synergy of interests and cultural and interconnections that have been moving very rapidly in the last decades as globalization develops in the world. Therefore, so if you go back to the 19th century and you remember that there were already Mexicans living in some states in the southwest of the U.S. of today, and this phrase that I just quoted there is something that I read that it really reflects what happened to some of those Mexicans that were Mexicans living in Mexico, which was then Texas, etc., and then suddenly the border crossed them, and suddenly they became Americans. And since then, the issue of migration and connection between Mexico and the U.S. people begin to integrate itself. Then the U.S. begins to pick up its fantastic development, and Mexican workers begin to come to help build the United States. With the Chinese in the railways, that's why, for example, there is a huge Mexican community in Chicago, because workers were following the routes and the construction of the railways who stopped in Chicago, and therefore they settled. And today we have a long-term standing Mexican-American community in Chicago. And California and Texas and Arizona, and California particularly, the famous agricultural workers picking up crops that have created fantastic novels and literature and movies and personal histories. And of course, these networks and chains of social connections that are not unique to us, it's all over the world. When you have a settlement of Mexicans living in the U.S. that are still connected with their parents and friends and relatives in Mexico, the social networks begin to develop and root themselves. So we have now a huge interconnections of daily communications and interchanges and even now with the technology, daily Skypes and chats talking from Arkansas or even Kansas or even Alaska with Mexican towns in the southeast, in central Mexico. So it's a daily interchange of information on how are they doing. And of course, the paradigm, or one of the big things that created a turning point, was the Bracero program during the World War II. When, if you are interested to understand it, I was fascinated to see that when the both governments got together to discuss how Mexico can provide temporary workers for picking up the crops because of the lack of workforce in the U.S., the agreement took just a few weeks to be signed. Weeks, not years, just a few weeks. And the Bracero program was established. And the Bracero program had a lot of repercussions in the U.S. and in the Mexican community, and it's a very contested issue. But nevertheless, it's a very relevant background of what happened in the 40s, 50s, 60s in Mexico and the U.S. And of course, one concept that is now very much in the debate of today is circular migration. So if some of you have been visiting or knows the border and have been in Nogales or Laredo, Nuevo Laredo, or Tijuana, San Diego, if you talk to the people there, the older ones, they used to cross and come back daily without any problem. And there is a very connected bilateral border communities in which Mexicans and Americans share constantly the daily life. Now they have to have a visa, fast track lanes, etc., to cross. But the circularity at the border level and the circularity as a whole, in which Mexicans came to work, travel, work, and then go back, that stopped several years ago. And that had good things and bad things. Good things, because this temporary, with this cut of circularity, and there is a saying in Washington that I fully understand what it means, that many people think that there is nothing more permanent than a temporary worker. And probably it is true. But at the same time, the experience and empirical evidence shows that people, when they leave a country and go to work to have a better chance to live or to have an income or a better salary, they don't lose completely the ties with their community of origin, and they would like to go back. As it happens today, each year, in which Mexicans that still have families in Mexico go massively back during the Christmas time to spend some time with their families and neighbors and friends in their towns, and then they come back. So the circularity is a phenomenon that can be virtuous if you frame it correctly, and if you train and educate people that this is the rule that you need to follow. You can go, but you need to come back. We have positive experiences in Mexico, like with Canada, which probably you don't know, that we have a guest worker program with Panama for almost 40 years now. Each year, thousands of Mexicans go to the farms of Canada, pick up crops, some of them stay for 4 months, some up to 6 or 7 months, and they go back. And there are zero dropouts. They joke that it's because of the climate, but nevertheless, they don't stay in Canada. They go back. And they establish long-term relationships between the employer and the worker. And many Canadians now are compadres of the Mexican workers, and they go to Mexico. And it is a very virtuous cycle because they complement the Canadian labor force, and therefore they know that they can go, but they need to come back. And they do come back. And now, in the recent years, the H-2 visas, which are temporary visas for low-skilled agricultural or services workers, have grown exponentially. As far as I have been following and working on this issue, in the last 6-7 years, probably a little more, Mexicans begin to use more H-2 visas, and employers began to use more H-2 visas. And either though, if you go to the details, there are still complications in the management of those visas. The general concept of having a paper to come, work, and go back is beginning to work. And employers in the U.S. are beginning to realize that it's better to have somebody with a paper, bring him in, and send him back. And it's beginning to be a kind of a concept because of the difficulties of transiting Mexico or staying here in the U.S. without your lawful residence or permit to work. And then the second half of the 20th century, which, as you see there, I just pinpoint some of the elements that I think we need to understand the context of these last 40 years. And this is one. First, the U.S. economic boom, in which the demand for labor increased sensibly, and it corresponded with the Mexican demographic boom. So we have a policy in the 80s to control family planning that was successful in terms of lowering gradually the birth of growth of Mexico's, but nevertheless, we accumulated a big number of young men and women who were not able to join the labor market because the economy in Mexico didn't offer them enough employment. So we have a surplus of workers, and you have a huge demand for workers. So the market balanced itself, and many people find a job in the U.S., and they came, and many of them, and it's something to recognize, breaking the law. But there was no way to come in other way. There was no manner to get in. But the demand was here, and the push-pull factor existed for many years. And then the border became to be an issue of concern in Washington and then to Mexico, and now to both of us, in which the border, the common border, becomes a very critical place that we need to find ways to manage it better. Perceptions drives realities. And sometimes the perceptions driven by the media escalate things that are not really so bad or so harsh. The border, yes, has several problems, but it has also several positive things. Probably some of you don't know that Mexico is the second or third trading partner to the U.S., just after Canada, and with China we're competing. But U.S. sells to Mexico more than to the rest of Latin America together. So it's a $500 billion trade between Mexico and the U.S. And 70-80% of that trade goes through the border. So we have massive thousands of containers crossing daily the Mexico-U.S. border and the Mexico-U.S. port of entry. So we have work, and I have here a dear, dear friend and colleague of mine, Mr. Bersin, who we have developed ways to how to manage that flow, to make a legal border, a safe border, a modern and updated border, and at the same time, a safe border. Huge challenge for both countries due to the massive flows of people and goods. So we started the dialogue, and I was lucky enough to participate in 1996, I think it was, when we started dialoguing with INS of those times to discuss how can we work together to have a legal, safe, and orderly flow of people or migration. Legal, safe, and orderly. That three words have become kind of a mantra, difficult to implement and difficult to conceptualize. What do you mean by legal, safe, and orderly? And then 2001 comes, and probably you know because you are experts or interested on international relations and in Mexican affairs, the change of Mexico, Mexico's party in power, the Fox and the PAN party, win the elections in 2000, and Fox becomes president, and there was this kind of demographic democratic bonus. So Fox decided to push for a shared responsibility agreement on immigration. And I was part of the team that started the discussions with the State Department, with Justice, with INS, to see how can we frame a way to have a better flow of people between our countries. But we coined the phrase of shared responsibility because since then, we understood very well in Mexico that if something was to be done between the two parts, we need to have our own shared responsibility, of course, as the U.S. And we should find a way to accommodate our interests. So discussions started, and unfortunately, and very dramatically, 9/11 came and everything changed, as you know. And therefore, the border became an issue of security, and the dialogue changed completely from migration to security. And after 11 years, we are back now to discuss, the U.S. is back again to discuss immigration reform. The whole enchilada concept, which is here, was an expression used by my boss of those days, in which it is a joke in Mexico that we didn't get the whole enchilada, not even the nachos or nothing, but the whole enchilada concept was an integrated view of the issue. What do you do with the people that are already here? What do you do with people that want to come to work for some time? How we do a better and safer border? And how does Mexico needs to do its job to have a better and most stronger economic and social development to keep our people in Mexico instead of trying to find a job in Mexico? So it was an integrated concept, complicated, terribly complicated. Nevertheless, it was a conceptual view of things of the deepened structural relations between Mexico and the U.S. So 9/11 came, it changed everything. And then the common border became a national security issue. And we have reached, and it is something that is also a little known probably for some in Washington or in Mexico City, we have developed in these years what I think is an unprecedented level of dialogue and cooperation and trust and building trust and building institutional trust, not only personal relations. And Mexico and the U.S. began to understand their views and began to see that they can disagree and they can agree on some things. And when we have disagreements, we agree that it's a natural thing that happens with such a complicated and asymmetric relation. Nevertheless, in arms trafficking, in fighting drugs, in fighting trafficking and smugglers, in fighting arms, in fighting, there is a long way still to go, but we are much better when we started and I started working, which finger pointing was a natural thing to happen. Now we have, of course, differences, but those differences are channeled through mechanisms that we can discuss and sometimes and many times agree on how to move on the agenda. Let me make one clarification that I forgot to do. I'm talking here as a private citizen, not as a public official. I am now in private practice, so when I talk about we, it's because I still have the chief of government, but it's not we, it's them. Please take into account that. So now, this is something that is obvious. The geography has been made of Mexico a country of source, transit, and destiny of flows. Not only of people, but of many things, including drugs from Colombia, arms from the U.S., and people not only from Central America, but from all over the world, as I will show you in a moment. So transiting Mexico is a huge issue for Mexico. How does a country so big as Mexico, with so much needs in social development, in education, in housing, deals with these flows of people crossing our territory without papers, trying to get into the U.S.? At the same time, we are a source of millions of Mexicans that are living today, as Steve's mentioned, 11 million, 1 out of 10 Mexicans live in the United States. And then, of course, we are receiving now more Central Americans and foreigners from other nationalities that are staying in Mexico. So for Mexico, migration is at the core of our own perception of what are Mexicans, what do we want to be. This graph that I didn't have a time to update it, but the line and the trend downwards continues on to today, shows you that the impact that started not only in 2007 with a recession in the U.S., but before that, flows of Mexicans to the U.S. have dramatically slowed down and fell. The numbers that when I started in 1995, by the way, in 1996, working on these issues, reach a peak of 1.7 million arrests or apprehensions at the border. Not people, arrests. Now we're talking even of 300,000, 400,000. It's a dramatic change. And that has to do with several reasons. One of them, of course, is the recession in the U.S. As I mentioned, Mexicans in Mexico and in the U.S. connect daily by the web, and they know whether there is or not a chance to work in the U.S. They know exactly. They know exactly the risks that they are facing now to cross the border, which is extremely difficult now. They know that the trafficker is a bad guy now. He used to be a facilitator. Now it could be a criminal. And a trafficker is charging them much more than before, so it needs to be an expensive endeavor if you want to travel illegally to the U.S., And of course, there is a better economic and social environment in Mexico that makes people balance that probably I will stay because I'm not doing so bad. Of course, there is an extreme problems of economic and social equality and income and poverty in Mexico, but nevertheless, many people think that it's better to stay. And finally, one dramatic element is that transiting through Mexico has become a very risky experience because of gangs, of organized crime that attack them, assault them, extort them, kidnap them, or even kill them, as the dramatic experience we have in Tamaulipas some 2 years ago, in which Central Americans were killed by a criminal group identified as Los Zetas. So now all of these things combined, some of them are probably temporary, but some of them are structural, seems to be, and one element, additional element that I was forgotten to mention to you, is demographics. Demographics is a critical thing to understand in both countries. Mexico has reached the peak of the young people, and its curve of demographic growth is beginning to go down. And it's going to go down. So Mexico soon is going to be a country of older people, not necessarily old people, but older people. So the demographic bonus of young generation of 9 million people between 16 to 24 years old are still pressing the labor market in Mexico, but it's diminishing. So demographic push is not that strong as it used to be for many decades. So all of that explains why apprehensions and returns from the U.S. of Mexicans have lowered down sensibly, and the trend seems to be a trend that will continue to go down until it stabilizes. And then the Central American case. And here I would like to raise the point for your attention, because I think this is a critical issue that needs to be thought about. Also, as you see, the decline of Central Americans going through Mexico has dramatically fallen. For the same reasons that the Mexicans, the Central Americans understand well, that there is no jobs, that there is crime, that there is risks, that is most costly, etc., etc. So they have decided to stay in Central America. If I can have a chance or time to build up the 2011 and 2012, even in numbers we have already in Mexico, the numbers have begun to pick up again. And the great and big, for me, fascinating and challenging new experience, a new paradigm, is that many Central Americans are coming to Mexico to stay, not to the U.S., because Mexico is offering them a better condition. Even the conditions are not necessarily a boom, but they are better than what they are in Honduras, in El Salvador, or Guatemala. So now we are beginning to experience bigger flows of Central Americans crossing the border without papers, of course, some of them trying to get still to the U.S., but many of them staying in Mexico. Unfortunately, many of them minors traveling alone. So when I was on the secretary last year, I had a chance to go and live directly the drama of these young men, boys and girls, some of them as young as 10, 11 years old, traveling alone from Honduras, trying to reach Los Angeles by themselves. So it's a very complicated human issue also. So what I did in this map is just to show you the complexity. The government has, the Mexican officials and academia knows that the routes and the routes that migrants follow and are, it's getting very complicated because there are controls and it is not easy, and they now need to look for safer places. So moving through the sea, moving in the Mexico or in the Gulf of Mexico or in the east side of Mexico. So you have several routes. And the border region, which I will elaborate in a moment, the southern border of Mexico with Guatemala and Belize is probably one of the most challenging affairs and pending affairs Mexico has. This is a border that is extremely porous, practically with no control, with a lot of violence and a lot of human rights violations, and the Mexican government has tried to deal with it, but it is an issue of resources, of political decision, of strategy, and developing Central America. That's why I put this photograph for you, which is not new. Now, many of you have seen probably pictures or even films about this train, which in Mexico we call La Bestia. And it is not La Bestia only because many people die on this intention to try to get to the U.S. jumping into these trains, because it's a very difficult thing to do. As you can imagine, traveling in those conditions in any movement of the train, in any unexpected stop or any movement, they can fall down. We have several people died, injured, amputated, very many young men and women. And of course, they are subjects and victims of criminals that extort them, beat them, rape them, or kill them. So this is one example of the huge challenges when you have a massive flow of people transiting through your country. And I have been fortunate to have a world view in terms of what happens in other regions of the world. And this is one of the most complicated issues all over. What do you do with these flows of people? How do you stop them? How do you control that? Particularly being Mexico, a country that has so many other needs for the Mexicans, for the social basic needs of Mexicans that are still living in extreme poverty. So this example of Central America, and that's why I quoted the Central America challenge, is something that Mexico and the U.S. needs to think seriously what to do in the next immediate years. Traffickers, of course, are making a business now. So the use of traffickers have increased dramatically, both for Mexicans and Central Americans and other nationalities, because they know that at least they hope that this trafficker or smuggler can help them to get through. But trafficking is a huge crime, and trafficking of men and women and kids is a huge crime. So Mexico issued a special law against traffickers and trata de personas to begin to be more effective in combating trafficking of men and women and children in Mexico, from Mexico, and from other countries. So as you see, there is a pattern of using of smugglers to cross into the U.S., and they hire them usually at the border region. And now they are hiring them from Honduras, El Guatemala, El Salvador, to take them through all the journey until the northern border. So trafficking and smuggling is a very perverse effect when you don't have a way of channeling the flows in a legal manner. And this is an example also of what Mexico and the U.S. face, and we are working together, the two countries working together in terms of what do we do of doing extracontinentals or third nationals from beyond Latin America try to get into the U.S. through Mexico once again. And this map shows you briefly, for example, the ways in which Chinese travel to get into Mexico. And this explains you how fascinating in a way and dramatic at the same time efforts people do to try to get where they want to be, basically in this case to the U.S. The ways and the experience we have when we control and get control of these people in Mexico, the stories they tell you how long did it take to get to Mexico coming out from China. In these extremely long and difficult journeys without papers, subject to exploitation and trafficking or smuggling, and paying incredible amounts of money to get into the U.S. or the Africans. As you can see in the little lines below, well, probably you cannot see them, but people from Eritrea that come through Sudan, Brazil, Colombia, Panama, Costa Rica, Salvador, Guatemala, and Mexico. 2 years journey, 3 years journey, stopped by the Mexican immigration authorities, frustrated because they know they're not going to make it, sent back to Eritrea or to India or to China or to Ethiopia or wherever. This is the Indians, which also are a huge inflow of Indians traveling through Mexico to get into the U.S., going to Sao Paulo, from Sao Paulo on up through South America, Central America, and Mexico. So talking about these issues in terms of simplifying the complexity is not the way to go. This is a very extremely social, political, economic, and human affair. So what we have learned in these years? First, is not only the U.S. and Mexico, but generally speaking, dealing with international migration is an issue driven by perceptions and domestic political calculations all over the world. Recession in Europe has triggered a debate about what to do with immigrants. Recession in Central America, recession in Mexico, recession in South America, in the Far East, recession impacts the way people perceive immigrants. And therefore, the calculation has to do with domestic considerations. And probably this is one of the things that we have learned, at least I have learned, and many people have learned, that the immigration reform in the U.S. is a domestic affair that has to do with the domestic forces and the domestic way Congress is going to be dealing with this issue and the regional and local impacts in California, in Florida, in Arkansas, in Texas, in California, wherever. It's not only Mexicans, it's from all over the world. So it's a structural thing, a very relevant thing that we understand has to do with U.S. domestic politics. So that's why Mexico and the U.S., I think, have developed in a positive way to understand each other's points of view and needs, with trying to be respectful and building up trust. And of course, trust, not only in international relations, as you know, but in personal relations. Trust is difficult to win, but it's very easy to lose. So things have to be managed constantly to build up and to see what the shared responsibility means in terms of migration between Mexico and the U.S. I am convinced that there is no other issue that affects more Mexicans and Americans than these ones. Because if you talk to Mexicans in Mexico, and I was sharing with Steve before coming in that I have been, since I work on these issues in Mexico, talking to the people in the streets, or a taxi driver, or a waiter, or a friend, asking if they have any experience with the U.S. And it's amazing how many of them say yes. I was there, I have a brother, I have a cousin, I have a compadre, I have a friend, I have a neighbor, I was there and then I came back. It's amazing how it impacts remittances, culture, and now with technology, daily connections. And if you talk to the American people, and you talk to hundreds of thousands of employers that have Mexican workers, and that they praise the hardworking people they have, the values, the family values, they are loyal, decent, hardworking people in daily experiences of contact between Mexicans and Americans. And the Mexican culture is gradually being more deeply rooted in the U.S., and Mexican restaurants and Mexican music and Mexican culture. And in Mexico, we also have developed a new sense of what the Americans means to Mexico. So there is not more that animosity that used to be for many decades. It's, yes, we understand the difference, but we are beginning to really understand each other. So migration, border management, human rights and security, I think, will continue to be one of the priority issues in our agenda. And I stop a moment on human rights because Mexico, and I was fortunate to work on it last year, issued a new immigration law in 2011. And then the regulations and the specific administrative regulations. And this new immigration law in Mexico is driven by one basic or three or to some basic principles. One of them is human rights respect. Human rights respect with migrants in Mexico. Human rights respect comes from the Constitution of Mexico, which was changed in the Calderón administration, Article 1 of the Constitution, to make human rights as the principal guidance of the Mexican rule of law. So now human rights has become embedded, legally speaking, as a core element to driven Mexican migration policies. Of course, we have enforcement. Of course, the law explains what do you do when you are illegal in Mexico, what the authority needs to do. And of course, we detain and return to their countries of origin hundreds of thousands of Central Americans or people, as you saw from last year when I was on the secretary, we stopped in Mexico and returned to their places of origin almost 23 nationalities from all over the world, which has a very difficult impact in terms of money, in terms of operations, in terms of corruption, in terms of human rights, but it's a daily work Mexico does. So we need to have, between Mexico and the U.S., better coordination, better sharing of information, and I say here joint diagnosis because sometimes we know still very little about each other's views. So the challenge we need to do is to continue intensifying a dialogue, and that's why, Steve, I thank you very much for this opportunity so I can share with you these views and I can listen to your views to make our effort to understand better what is going on between Mexico and the U.S., how does that impact immigration reform in the U.S. And finally, I quoted here regional migration perspective because I think that in the near future, Mexico and the U.S. need to work together in Central America. I need to work in a long-term, comprehensive view of what to do in that region, because that region is becoming a failing region and is becoming in the risk of becoming a narco region. And this is the vicinity of Mexico in the south. But it affects the U.S. also. So we need to think long-term on a regional perspective. So what has changed in the last 15 years? First, as I already mentioned, demographics in Mexico, which is a critical structural issue, Ms. Lindsay. Second, Latino demographics in the U.S., which I don't want to elaborate, but you know much better what I'm talking about, that Latino demographics in the U.S. Then the Mexican economy, which is good news for everybody. And I'm not quoting the Mexican government, but I'm quoting IMF, World Bank, the Davos Forum, the Financial Times, which called us the Aztec Tiger, in which the Mexican economy perspective is really very good. So under the, if you look at it in the context of where the world is moving and the European crisis and the fiscal deficit here, et cetera, Mexico is doing very well. It has very solid macroeconomic numbers. It has a forecast of growth for this year and the next year, much better than Brazil, Argentina, or India. So we are doing quite well. So the new government, the Peña administration, is trying to get this momentum to consolidate Mexico's structural reforms, Mexico's economic growth, and creating jobs and employment. So you have a positive forecast plus demographics going down. You can see that Mexico is going to be, hopefully for me and for you and for everybody, in a very good path in the next years. So one question and one comment in terms of what happens with migration between Mexico and the U.S. from the point of view of a labor market, a bilateral labor market. We need to think of productivity. We need to think of competition in the world. We need to think how to integrate our labor force to be more competitive regionally. It is not an issue only of illegality or not illegality. It's beyond that. It's social and economic forces that drives migration. So how can we complement our labor force? Mexico has huge American investments in Mexico, and the trade, I already said, it's $500 billion per year. See, it's one of the biggest partnerships in the world. So you have to integrate, sooner or later, your labor force in a productive and positive way. The border has changed dramatically. I know it is an issue in Washington, but it is a dramatic change what we have experienced, the people that have been working on these issues for many years. The border of today has nothing to do with the border of 15 years ago. Today is a very challenging endeavor to try to cross the border, extremely dangerous and extremely difficult. So people know that. People are rational. People understand the risks. Some of them try to do it, sometimes losing their lives, but they understand the rationale of it. Technology impact on migrant social networks. I won't elaborate, but it is a fascinating bilateral phenomenon how much integration is taking place today in the web. And finally, what I already said, we have to build up the momentum of having a better good cooperation and a better good environment between Mexico and the U.S. beyond migration. Today, the Peña administration has put economic investment and social development as the key elements of our relation. Of course, security, border management, migration will still be there. But we will need to look forward in the Mexico-U.S. relation in the next years in a broader spectrum, and not only focusing on security and migration, but the broader things that are beyond and well-founded between the two countries. And so finally, what I think is coming next. First, and it's probably an obvious statement, this debate that you're having in Washington and in the U.S. about the new immigration reform, I think it's a major political, social, and cultural challenge and opportunity for the United States. I understand the complications. I have been following it in the media. I have talked to friends here and in Mexico. It's a long way to go still, but nevertheless, its implications are deep and long-term for the U.S. But Mexico, I think, rightfully, has a big interest in how this debate evolves. And it would be natural to any country or any government that has so many millions of its nationals involved in a decision taken by other country to follow up and to see how things evolve, how is this going to benefit or affect Mexican nationals, the common border, the eventual temporary flow of people. How can we do it, if we should do it together or just unilaterally? And if we do it together, what role can Mexico play to make Mexicans and the U.S. and Mexican workers and employers to follow established rules and beginning to have an orderly, safe, and legal flow? And that's, I think, one of the key challenges we will face in the next months and years. Of course, there's corruption, smuggling, and trafficking that needs to be fighted more decisively. We have to develop in Mexico social and economic policies to reintegrate Mexican nationals returning from the U.S. And this is another probably structural new paradigm in the Mexico-U.S. relations. For the first time ever, we have zero net growth in Mexican flows to the U.S. And we have massive numbers of people either deported or voluntarily returned to Mexico. So Mexico needs to think what to do with its national coming back. If you look at the numbers just in the last 3-4 years, it has been amazing the number of people that have been returned to Mexico by the government. And we don't know exactly where are they, what are they doing. So Mexico needs to think in reintegrating its population and make it a positive cycle of experience, learned, new abilities, and integrating them to their places of origin. And finally, with Central America, we need to think on a comprehensive, not only immigration package, as I say here, but a sustained, a broader view of economic development. Mexico needs to work on its southern border. And we need to think also what will happen in the midterm if Mexico's economic development continues to be the case and Central America is not in a positive path to development itself, developing itself. Mexico could become a receiving country for the first time in our history. And that is also a huge challenge and opportunity if we do it right. So finally, I put this photograph just as an image for you to keep, that this is a migrant with a Virgen de Guadalupe in the back, which is usually how they try to get to hope for a miracle, with a Border Patrol car. And as I say here, I hope that we can work together to end this image for the next years. Thank you very much.
Gustavo, thank you very much. That was a very complete picture and some very trenchant comments in history. I'm pleased to welcome to our podium now Dr. Lindsay Lowell, and so glad that traffic was kind to you to allow you to join us this morning. I think it would be disingenuous of me and probably a little bit cruel to ask you to discuss Gustavo's comments from the very beginning. But in lieu of that, one of the things, the many things that Dr. Lowell is an expert on is the complexity of the U.S. visa system, and also the history of immigration reform. And so I would ask Lindsay, if you would talk to us a little bit about what the prospects are for changing the current system, discuss a little bit about circularity from this end, and also about the current dialogue that we have in our national political scene about citizenship. Dr. Lindsay Lowell.
Hello. My apologies to all of you, to Gustavo, who I haven't seen for a while, Stephen and Michael.
Can you still hear me even better now, right? So again, just my apologies, just the usual round of carpool mishaps this morning. I am sorry I didn't hear all that Gustavo had to say. He is, of course, well-placed to have perspective on this. I've known him on these issues for a couple of decades. And I think the issues have changed. In some ways, the basic dynamics have not. It's enforcement versus now what we call amnesty. But the roots of Mexican migration go back a long, long ways. And I'm not talking about fantasies about the Reconquista. I'm talking about dynamic labor migration from Mexico, often with the collaboration of the Mexican government, say in the case of the Bracero, or even in the returns of the 30s. But a cry need for a new vision of how the two countries might or may not work together. And it is a new dynamic. When I was involved with IRCA, we talked about legalization. We talked about a different face of the rationale. We talked about single males who are highly circular and the ideas they had earned equity in the United States by working. There was a dignity to working, and they'd earned a certain equity because with a wink and a nod would let them work in the United States. And at that time, the enforcement was worksite. That was the real novel thing being introduced. That was the historic change over the 50s. And what did we get? Well, we got border and now a huge, a really surprisingly large volume of removals going on, or deportations, if you will. Not a lot of worksite. And we talk about amnesty because, in a way, the metric has changed. It's far too casual to say, oh, they're just migrants. There has been a violation of the law on both sides, that of the employer, that of the worker, and that of the government that's kind of, again, with a wink and a nod, continued to let these kinds of things fester over time. And in a way, I think what that's done, unsurprisingly, is cause some of the problems we have now with trying to address these issues. So the common way of framing this is that fool me once, you know, fool me twice kind of thing. The argument is that the original IRCA compromise was to have enforcement. That never really occurred. And so therefore, why should we do legalization this time around? Well, that's not really quite right, right? Because we have done pretty aggressive enforcement along the border. We've more than doubled the number of border agents. We have a huge impact on mobility across the border. We've changed the nature of circularity in a lot of fundamental ways, although I think the bigger change is not really caused by enforcement. It's caused by a maturation of the migrant stream. What does that mean? It means that we legalized close to 3 million people in the early 1990s. They came in with their families and they started settling. And over time, the circulation kind of dies in and of itself. I mean, we get probably 15 to 20% of Mexico's working age population. The sex ratio in many states is 0.8. That is 8 men for every 10 women. I mean, it's a phenomenal process of international migration and mass migration. So that's changed. And along with it, a lot of the discussion, I think, is no longer simply about we have earned amnesty, right? There's some, at least, a factor of recognition that law has been broken. People have to work their way into amnesty. I don't like the idea of talking about it as citizen. I guess to an extent because I'm a little bit too much of an insider, and so to me citizenship is really about first you get normalized status as a legal permanent resident, then you have a 5-year run, and some of the proposals on dealing with this issue and making the migrant earn their right to stay have to do with things like making citizenship unobtainable or lengthening the time to citizenship. So it's a dramatic rethinking of how we do immigration in the United States. And that's hugely different. So that's a change in the discussion. And a change in the discussion on enforcement is that we now have right in front of us removal. So you saw that Gustavo had a new dynamics as the lead on his slide. And we do have a new dynamic. 400,000, 300,000 Mexicans a year. That's a huge process which has led to a lot of family separation, some kind of shady practices, let's say, in the United States in terms of how this is enforced. So a lot of concern about how that process is going on. And because the volume is so great, this is a major issue within Mexico. And so that's also part of the fact that the nature has changed. We have now a set of families settled in the United States with a large proportion of them having children, being married, settled families with U.S.-born native children. So the dynamics have changed fundamentally. When we're talking about removals, we're talking about removals in some cases of parents of U.S. citizens. And so that's changed. And another thing that's changed that is phenomenal is that the return migration has changed. So a lot of Mexicans going back and staying. And this has caused new problems, novel problems for Mexico that, again, Gustavo kind of touched on. All of these things make solving the problem much more difficult than they were back in Erica's time. It is a much more complex phenomenon. It's no longer just simply legalization for enforcement. It's about addressing a whole range of a mature migration stream that's developed over, well, far more than 20 years, but a long time. I just want to mention briefly that I've been involved with a project, a U.S.-Mexico binational study group. This is the third one I've been involved with. Gustavo's aware that the government sponsored one back in the mid-1990s, included Mexican and U.S. scholars. They did a report. They projected, rightly, but maybe for the wrong reasons, that Mexican migration would indeed start to slack off in this particular period of time. And there are a lot of structural reasons, including a new dynamic in the Mexican economy, that might lead us to think that future Mexican migration, the pressures won't be as great. And that's a good situation because it allows us to manage the situation more proactively. At least that's the theory. This binational study group that's just completed really covered a whole range of topics. We talked about population, obviously, this slackening of Mexican migration. First-time migration is down. Return migration seems to be up, at least on a relative basis. Of course, you have to talk about employment, and again, that's become a more complicated area, but also a large team talking about education. So we know why the DREAM Act exists, not just because of issues of equity, but because 20 years ago, we didn't have a large population of college-age individuals who had been raised in the United States, who get age 14, 15, and are surprised to understand that, whoops, I'm not supposed to be here. That's the real face of a complex migration stream. Health is another area that we looked at. And health is another area that really kind of all of a sudden reveals the kind of funny things that happen with immigration. In this case, the health of migrants seems to degrade the longer they stay in the United States and they adopt U.S. habits and eating behaviors, which is of a concern and leads to different kinds of policy considerations and issues. It certainly will be an issue that will be involved if we ever have an amnesty. And in no small way, personal security. So we had a team that looked at security issues. And here, this is not just the difficulty of crossing the border or the problems with removals, and basically the whole climate of risk that has changed migrant and families' calculus, but the real difficulties that they face. We're talking about, everybody knows, tens of thousands of people killed in Mexico in gang wars, and that has changed the calculus. We don't have good numbers on this, but there's every reason to think that this has chilled the climate in many ways, that migrants don't want to risk crossing the border anymore because they've become susceptible and open to gang activity, and a lot of informal kind of belief that it's driven Mexicans north as well at the same time. So that's a new climate of security that's changed that needs to be addressed. And, of course, it's one of the things that Gustavo talked about was greater binational coordination on these issues. But the other thing this implies is that Mexico is going to have to, and will probably, and has been, you know, as Gustavo knows, step up increasingly to the plate in actively being involved in the migratory phenomenon. In this case, dealing with people who are being returned, but also, as he was mentioning on one of his points, helping to make the entire process of migration more transparent and safe. And nowhere is this going to be more, perhaps more problematic for Mexico than in granting access to social programs in Mexico. So this talks to issues like totalization, returning Mexican migrants, is both an opportunity for the United States and a challenge for Mexico. It's an opportunity because control, which is what Erica said we were going to do, really opens up this possibility that a lot of migrants will return. But how do you facilitate that if that's a positive outcome of controlling the migration stream? So these are some of the complexities. What will happen in the United States, let me just say, is anybody's guess. I don't see that there's a lot of pressure on the Republicans to move in the next year or two. but they might. Having said that, devil's in the details. How do you frame the enforcement versus the other kinds of aspects? How do you frame amnesty? Which comes first? These things have yet to find any real widespread agreement. And until they do, I think it's going to be very difficult to break the logjam.
Lindsay, thank you very much for that. We've come to the point in our presentation today where we're opening up the forum for questions from the audience. I'd like to ask everybody to please turn off their cell phones or at least put them on vibrate mode if you could. Heard a couple of chirps already here. We have interns with microphones here today, so if you have a question, please raise your hand. We'll get a microphone to you, and please state your name and also your affiliation. And if you could, keep your questions fairly short so that we have time to have a good, broad discussion and give everybody a chance to participate. So, Dan Whitman.
Thanks, Steve. Great presentation. I'm Dan Whitman. On Tuesdays, I'm with something called the Washington Internship Institute. NAFTA was meant to rectify some of these issues, freedom of movement, the dispersal of incentives for investors to actually maybe self-rectify between poor and rich in North America. Was it naive to have NAFTA? And if we could have done it again, how might we do it again? Well, in your perception, how has NAFTA not met the needs that you have defined? Thanks, Steve.
And Lindsay, if you'd like to chime in as well.
I think NAFTA is probably it should be considered as a success in terms of how amazing explosion of trade between the two countries it has created and jobs in the two sides of the border. As you will remember, there was a huge concern in the U.S. with the sucking labor market of Mexico, and that hasn't happened. An investment of American companies in Mexico has grown. And Mexico is today one of the biggest exporters in the world. We are, for example, number one exporter in the world of computer screens, of refrigerators. We are becoming a huge exporter of cars. So when you talk about 500,000 billions of trade, you have to realize that NAFTA made and played its role. I don't think that the promoters of NAFTA in those days thought that this was going to be a magic bullet that will single out the problems in Mexico. But I think that that was a turning point in terms of Mexican economy open. We have several free trade agreements signed already with more than 40 countries in the world. Probably the Mexican economy is one of the most open economies worldwide. And it has proven to make the Mexican industry more competitive. Now, labor force was not included deliberately at the negotiations, as oil was not included in the negotiations, because it was, since then, and it continues to be, an extremely sensitive pair of issues, politically speaking, both from Mexico and the U.S. There is a labor agreement, a side labor agreement, that we have forgotten, that this was signed as part of the preconditions that were established by the U.S. Congress to sign NAFTA. But we know really little bit about what happened with that side labor agreement. There are NAFTA visas between Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. that few people know about them. So I think that I think it was a success. I think that now Mexico and the U.S. have to work out ways to enhance more economic cooperation and integration. That has to do with productivity in the region and having a long-term view that Mexico and the U.S. are not competing with each other, but they are competing with China, with India, with Brazil, with Russia, with Europe, with the Southeast as a whole. And therefore, the North American countries, including Canada,
I think they should develop a view of how to be sure that the productivity of its labor force is fully used. And one of those is integrating labor markets. Thank you.
I would just point out, relative to the question, there was no freedom of movement or an expansion of movement inherent in NAFTA. There was the TN visa, which trade NAFTA visa, which is kind of an H-1B sort of like thing. Very easy movement for the Canadians. You still have to go through a consulate interview in Mexico, and probably as many, if not more, Mexicans come in on the H-1B visa as the TN. And, you know, that's a... How do you evaluate that? I mean, in some ways, NAFTA certainly was a success in trade. Mexico went from, I think, fifth or sixth trade partner to second and first for a short period of time, only be displaced by China. So I think in that regard, it's been a success. Did it, as Bill, create pressures to keep Mexicans home? No, not really. To some extent, we'll never know, right? But certainly it didn't have a big effect. Now, IRCA, in 1988, had what was called the RAW program, Replenishment Agricultural Workers, which ag was going to trigger if it seemed like there were shortages in agriculture caused by legalization. Never occurred. But consider that we have about 150,000 temporary migrants coming from Mexico every year now. That number alone is about a half of the net flow that we observed in the late 1990s or even 10, 15 years ago coming from Mexico on an unauthorized basis. So that's why people like Doug Massey argue that these large temporary programs have in part substituted out for the unauthorized flow of workers that we've seen in prior decades. There's no doubt that that is part of the story. At least 120 of these are lesser skilled workers on the H-2 visas. And just to point out what Gustavo is also saying, is the complexity of the issue is my research in the H-2s in agriculture suggests that the really huge increase we've seen in those numbers from 15,000 in the 1990s to 65, 70,000 today, the increase, and it's an uncapped visa, the big increase in those numbers has to do really for a demand for high technology farms in the United States to have a dependable source of contracted labor. And this is precisely the kind of bilateral thing that Mexico and the United States could manage. And at these volumes, I think it's doable. Numbers get larger, we'll talk about it.
I think we had a question here.
Yeah, thank you. Margaret Hayes, and I'm a consultant in security questions. But Gustavo, I have a question. Do you have statistics on the demographics of returnees, or those, the devueltos? Are these young people, uneducated? Are they people who kind of range across the demographic spectrum? I'm curious as to the impact on Mexico of the devolution. Certainly in Central America, the Caribbean countries have complained a lot about the returnees. And if you could, a second question, is Mexico spending enough to do the kind of enforcement and management of the migration that you have described? Thanks.
Thank you very much for your question. Demographics in terms of the people returned, there is an ongoing poll that we, when I was at the government, asked the Colegio de la Frontera Norte to begin to look at it more closely, because this is an issue that is worth to comment a little bit about it, because when you think about the numbers of people that have been returned to Mexico by Homeland Security authorities, and you look at the results and the numbers published in the statistics of DHS 3-4 years ago to today, you can add up more than 1 million people. That's a huge number of people. What we know is that before, in this poll that is made at the northern border of Mexico by a university, it's a research center called Colegio de la Frontera Norte, the people that were returned in the 90s, late 90s, said 50% of them said that they would like to go back again, that they will try to go back. Last number that I saw, it was only 30%. So 70% were saying, that's it, I'm going home. Now, the profile of those returnees is very variable. Some of them, many of them, are recent incomers into the U.S. that have just been picked up at the border region. But many of them are long-term residents or living in the U.S., many of them with 10, 15 years of living in the U.S. Those are the ones that are facing a very crucial dilemma for their lives because they don't have any roots anymore in Mexico. They have a job, usually, and they have family connections and social networks in Chicago or in L.A. or in wherever in the U.S. where they were picked by the authorities because they don't have papers. So there is no way to argue anything in favor of them except that there is an issue of probably breaking families and creating a challenge for Mexico to return them and for each one of them what to do because they are already integrated into the American system. Fully integrated, even culturally integrated. And then there is one very complicated affair in which many of those returnees are coming out from jails in the U.S. I don't have the numbers in my mind, but at least 20% of the people returned have come out from jails in the U.S. And you have misdemeanors and felons returned to the border region or to the interior of Mexico, but then you have that new challenge because these people, some of them are not really criminals or serious criminals, but some of them are. And because they are expelled and returned to Mexico, when they go into Juarez or Laredo or Nogales or whatever, there is an environment of crime and insecurity in which they can easily be co-opted by the local gangs or organized crime to become members of them. So that, I think, it's a huge challenge that Mexico and the U.S. have to think about what to do, what's the best thing to do to deal with this issue. And in terms of the phenomenon of how much is Mexico investing, if I understood correctly, in terms of migration and controlling migration and illegal migration, I will divide it in two. One is that the immigration authority in Mexico, the Instituto Nacional de Migración, we have a kind of INS that you used to have here. It's an institution that has the responsibility, and according with a new law issued in 2011, it's the institution that deals with border control, regularization of people that are foreigners living in Mexico that like to stay, either temporary or permanently, or even with a foreign affairs ministry to naturalize foreigners that want to become Mexican, the same thing that you have here. The challenge and the problems they face is that, first, the southern border of Mexico is shorter, of course, than the northern border. It's only 1,000 kilometers, but it's an extremely difficult geographical area to control. You have jungle, you have river, you have mountains, and you have common border cities like in the U.S. and Mexico that have a daily crossing of hundreds of thousands of people from Guatemala that cross to Mexico or Mexicans to Guatemala. And then you have a big number of irregular points of crossing between ports of entry in which we don't have, or Mexico doesn't have, neither the resources or the enforcement authorities or the border patrol equivalent to control those flows. So what the Mexican government does is to stop these people as long as they began to go through Mexico. And I would like to raise for your attention one issue that has not really fully valued and considered, I think, in the U.S., that it is that the Mexicans implementing the law stopped and returned to Central America in a point in time, just 5 years ago, more than 400,000 people that were coming to the U.S. And they were stopped, detained for temporary processing in the Mexican migration facilities and returned to Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And we have arrangements with those governments to make that return in a safe and orderly manner. 400,000 in 1 year. Last year it was less, of course, 120,000. But still all of them, trying to get into the U.S. So, yes, money is needed, training is needed, institutional building is needed. Mexico issued a new legal framework that is a kind of updated way of looking at migration. Now I think that the new administration in Mexico has the opportunity to implement the law, but resources are needed.
Lindsay?
Let me add real quickly that there's a distinction here in removals or deportations and returnees. Again, 750 million return migrants in Mexico last part of this decade. So the numbers are phenomenal. The group did look at that using the Mexican census. Again, you know, in a kind of odd way, people like me get excited. The dynamics have changed so much that we're now actually using the Mexican census to tell us a lot about the migration flow from Mexico, which we didn't do even half a dozen years ago. So there's a lot of integration, a lot of fronts, even things like how we classify occupations and industries now a shared exercise with Canada and Mexico. I mean, the ways in which our governments are involved, from oil exploration to borders. I mean, it's a phenomenal amount of integration. On the return migration, looking at the census in Mexico, it seems pretty clear that removals are one thing that may be generating some of the return, but we don't know at all anything about the overlap. The AMIF survey tells us something. We don't know how effective removal is in actually slowing things down or causing return. We just don't know. But the characteristics of the removals probably are different than the returnees. Returnees, for example, tend to be a lot of family units, and tens of thousands of U.S. citizen-born children going back to Mexico. So it's a rather surprising picture in a way.
I think we have a question in the middle. Tell you what we'll do. Maybe we'll take about three questions. One, then you, and you, and then we'll go the next row down.
Yes, Gustavo, thank you for your informative briefing on immigration. I just have a question on the Mexican procedures for how they deal with immigrants coming out of Cuba, North Korea, or other places that don't have a very positive relationship with the United States. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Jose Pulido from Mitsui USA, and I wanted to ask about the remittances and the immigration issue. Now with better technology, it's much easier to compare methods of sending money back to Mexico. And do you think that's going to increase the amount of long-term workers or make them the term shorter because they can send more money than they can return faster? I'd like to hear your thoughts.
My name is Jordan Bruno. My question is primarily for Dr. Lowell. Curious, why do you believe there's so little attention, political and policy-wise, right now towards liberalizing low-skilled visas, something which presumably could solve a lot of the border security and illegal immigration problems that we currently see? Thank you.
Thank you for your question about Cuba and North Korea. There are different things. I haven't seen North Koreans in Mexico ever. We do have a flow of Cubans that pick up and go down. Some years ago, we experienced a big increase in Cuban flows through the peninsula de Yucatan, coming by boat or by yachts, and it was a complicated trafficking scheme between people in the U.S., people in the island, and people in Mexico trying to get these people through Mexico. And the procedure, and we have an agreement with Cuba. We have a migratory agreement with Cuba, different as the one that you have, but it was a response to try to prevent this thing to continue increasing because it created a lot of violence in Mexico. And we begin to face issues of crime between the traffickers and the Cuban mafia. So we started discussions with the Cuban government, and we had a bilateral agreement. The government has a bilateral agreement in which has two or three interesting points probably for you. One of them is that there is now an agreement that Cuba will take back some of the people that we have in our control, under certain preconditions and interviews by the consulate of Cuba in Mexico. They agreed to accept them back, which is something that was not the case with Cuba for many, many years, and which, as you know, once you left Cuba, you couldn't go back. In this case, one relatively important percentage of the Cubans detained in Mexico are sent back to Cuba. The others, and we have a huge issue, is that due to the Cuban Adjustment Act that the U.S. has, all of the Cubans that are coming to Mexico, basically the 99% of them are trying to get into the U.S. So they know that as far as they are able to touch U.S. land, they are immediately welcome and received. So the challenge is for Mexico, because these flows of people, some of them are not accepted in Cuba, and some, and many of them, all of them, can be accepted in the U.S. if they are able to get into the U.S. So what does Mexico needs to do? So we negotiated with Cuba. We stopped for some years the flows of illegal Cubans trying to get into Mexico. Numbers have arisen a little bit because now Ecuador has a very liberal policy of visas. So Cubans are going to Ecuador, and from Ecuador they began to walk or to make their journey into Mexico through Central America. And once they are in Mexico, the only thing they want to know is that if the government leaves them to continue, and they reach El Paso or Laredo or whatever, then they are in. So it's something that has to be carefully thought about in the U.S. and with Mexico and eventually with Cuba, because it could become a big issue in the next years. Thank you.
Sorry. Lindsay?
Sorry. May I answer the other?
Okay.
Very briefly, comment about the remittances. It's a very complicated and very relevant issue, as you know, because remittances to Mexico are not below $20 million per year. So it is a huge income for several hundreds and thousands of families in Mexico. Remittances that are usually small amounts, $300, $400 per month, but massively, in which, unfortunately, many families still live only off the remittances that they receive from their parents or their sons or husbands in the U.S. How did the recession affect those remittances? It's a curious phenomenon, because even though the overall amount of remittances went a little lower, the peso devaluated itself also, so the pesos that the Mexican families received were even more than what they used to receive, so they didn't suffer the impact. At the same time, what happens long-term when you have a population like the Mexicans here that could eventually decide to stay, gradually that family begins to break the ties with the family of origin and remittances begin to go down. So because of the number of people involved, we have had several years, including last year, the Mexico Banco de Mexico report still talks about more than $20 billion dollars in remittances to Mexico. So it's a huge income, and I think that regardless of what happens here, the ties of Mexicans with their families will continue to be an important source of income for those families behind. And finally, well, that's it. Thank you.
I think Gustavo answered the remittance question fairly well. I mean, clearly things are getting more complicated. 20 years ago, a lot of the remittances get counted in different ways. So in the past, it was worker remittances. In fact, workers carried the money back with them. And I think some of that might change. It's one of the inducements, for example, for temporary work programs is that you kind of use that as a mechanism for getting people back because the money goes with them or it's held for them until they do return. And so that's an important point. And to what extent does an electronic market for remittances change the game and being able to manage things in that way? But why do we have a problem liberalizing low-skilled visas? Lots of reasons. I mean, unions have traditionally not been favorably disposed toward the idea. I think they correctly see that large temporary work programs present a challenge to the workers they represent. That's a 200-year-old position that's not unique in any sense. What is unique is that seems to be changing a little bit. So recently you've probably read that the unions are considering things like using unemployment data to trigger changes in the numbers, or the EPI's take on commissions, which would change the volume of migration based, again, on assessment of shortages or demand. So unions may come around, but there's a whole block that of lobbyists that don't really like the idea of temporary work programs of the sort we're talking about, not the sort that lead to earned amnesty, but the sort that are really truly free moving. And the other reasons it's difficult is because how do you assess a shortage? Again, under IRCA, the idea is that workers once legalized would leave agriculture, and they did. It went from about being 90% unauthorized workers to about 10% in a handful of years. So that was supposed to induce shortages. The Department of Agriculture was released a program called the ROS program. Well, they didn't do it because they couldn't assess shortages. Assessing shortages is a very difficult thing to do, especially if you buy like I do, that agriculture is rapidly introducing technology in a lot of ways. It's naturally pushing downward the demand for labor. So if you bring in labor, you push down wages, which doesn't help people in those sectors, especially those who might want to unionize the sector. But as for liberalizing, let's, again, go back to the numbers, because people haven't got their heads wrapped around it. We see today about 140,000 legal permanent admissions, a flow of migrants from Mexico on an annual basis. It's really down low. Again, we bring in about 150,000 temporary workers annually. So we're in a position now where we have a very liberal flow on a relative basis, if not an absolute basis, because clearly there's still about 50% of agriculture that's unauthorized in the United States. And how do you do that? So how do you really run a program? So, for example, Bush changed the visa mechanisms. He changed the wage standard, and that led to an increased demand, no small amount. This administration has tightened up the wage standard, changed some of the admission standards, and probably that's ratcheted things down. But what do you mean by liberalizing? Because what that really means is addressing the difficulties that employers have in using the program, like housing, quality of housing, like transportation requirements, like wage standards, like rights. And getting that package right so in a way that employers will use these and not really undermine the U.S. labor market is a markedly tough thing to do, which is why, for example, President Obama, I think rightly, puts in stepped-up FLSA or labor law enforcement along with worksite enforcement. I think you have to – these things are very difficult to manage. And finally, again, given a two-cent argument for why you need bilateral management, one of the reasons Mexico's agricultural program with Canada has worked is, A, it's been tough love. They've basically singled out married men, which ups the likelihood that they're going to return. They've also got the Mexican government involved. So if you don't return, then you don't qualify to re-enter Canada to work again. That's a tough love kind of thing. I don't see the U.S. putting those kinds of practices into place. So that's another reason it's difficult to basically liberalize programs, because the intent of a temporary work program is people return. And getting that to happen is such a real challenge.
I'm sorry to announce that we've almost come to the end of our time here, but we do have just a couple of minutes for one last question. So if I could take one from this side of the aisle, and that'll be it. Afterwards, I invite you to come forward and to talk personally with our guests this morning, and I'm sure they'd be more than willing to answer your questions. Please go ahead.
Yes, I am. My name is Maria Huidobro from the Spanish Embassy. I appreciate a lot these presentations coming from a country where we also have immigration problems and economic recession problems that make immigration go up and down. I just wanted Mr. Maher to ask him if he could elaborate a bit more about the immigration from Central America to Mexico now. Just a bit out of curiosity, I would like to know if most of them go to Mexico just coming to the States, or some of them are beginning to go there legally to work in factories, wherever. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you for the question also. Central Americans have, particularly the Guatemalans, have been going through Mexico for a temporary work, historically to the southeast of Mexico, particularly to the coffee plantations and banana plantations in the southeast of Mexico. And this has a historic tradition in which literally 150,000, 200,000 people per year, families, complete families, moved to pick up the crops of coffee and banana in Mexico, and then they go back to Guatemala. That used to be a thing that the Mexican authorities just allowed. Now we have established, with the government, established some visas that legalize that flow and puts the employer with a much more clear obligations with these workers. And then also the government issued what is a kind of a temporary border crossing card in the Mexico-Guatemala and Belize border, in which Guatemalans and Belizeans can cross to work to Mexico at up to 100 kilometers, and then they go back to their places of origin. So we have also established a process of legalizing that circular flow at the border region between Mexico and Guatemala and Belize. But what I was referring to is that we have been experiencing in the last 2 years an increased flow of Central Americans, regardless of the recession in the U.S., either though they are trying to get still into the U.S. because the conditions in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala, in a way, also have deteriorated so much because of lack of opportunities and because of violence and gang violence, that people are really fleeing out because of security reasons. And then they are finding that in some niches in Mexico and some regions in Mexico which are doing particularly well, they can find a job either to stay or at least to earn some money to continue the journey to the north. So we have not a statistic yet because it's a new phenomenon, but we do have empirical evidence of Honduran and Salvadorian staying in the state of Jalisco or in the state of Zacatecas or in the state of Querétaro, which are beginning to create a challenge for the local authorities to see what shall they do with this population, because they are also low-skilled workers, subject to a lot of risks and exploitation, that are beginning to see Mexico as an option due to the extremely bad conditions they are facing in their countries. That's why I think that Central America is demanding attention of the international community, and particularly for Mexico, of course, and the U.S. and Colombia, and the region, to try to go to Central America with a more comprehensive view than just controlling the flows of people, but try to do international cooperation to systematically enhance institutions, law and order, security, and economic development, particularly in those three places.
Well, I think we've come to the conclusion of this session. I want to thank especially Gustavo Mojar, who's come all the way from Mexico City to be with us this morning, and also Dr. Lindsay Lowell from Georgetown University. Glad that you could make our session this morning, and if you would like to talk with either of these two gentlemen further, please come forward after we close. Please join me in a round of applause for our guests this morning.